So I'd like to start by thanking the organizers for invitation. So it's great to be here. And actually, I mean, I've been to many of the KATP meetings, but I've really not seen the room that full, you know. So I think KATP has to work on a new building. So this talk today, you know, will represent a little bit of change of gears compared to previous few talks, but I will try to make some connections both to the talks in the morning session and also to what we've heard before. So basically, this talk will be about a quest, you know, for controlling quantum world, or at least that's what we're thinking about. And so basically in this quest, what we're trying to do is we try to isolate and control simple quantum objects and build more and more complex quantum systems from them. And in the process, we would like to explore new physics with this kind of engineered many-body systems, and also explore new applications. For example, think about implementing new quantum algorithms, or maybe think about new protocols for communication and metrology. So in this talk, I will actually focus about this topic, about really creating and probing new states of matter. But I'd like to emphasize right from the beginning that these directions are very, very closely related. So in particular, here in Santa Barbara, you could think about sort of this work being in a kind of ultimate quantum rivalry. And you know, you can think, what is it, you know, who is with, you know, involved? So you can think maybe it's Google versus Microsoft versus the rest of the world. But it's actually not really that. It's much more fundamental in the sense that basically what this work's trying to address is really kind of two contradictory kind of trends in nature. And one is a controllability, and another one is scalability. And this challenge is not actually special for building quantum machines. So think about, for example, if you have a bunch of smart people and you want to kind of, you know, put them in a single organization, as this organization grows, it will be actually very difficult to control these people. So, and you know, for example, if you think about Google hiring a lot of physicists, you know, something will come out probably, but you know, you never know. So, anyway, so basically, in a kind of in this specific field, the current frontier is to really build the systems which are big enough and coherent enough that we can really try to perform the tasks which go beyond classical, modern classical computers. And for that, we need to start experimenting with systems composed of maybe 30 to 100 coherent, you know, strongly interacting qubits. So what will we do with these systems, at least in the near terms? So I would actually predict that most of the things which we will see coming really out of that will be actually science, at least in the near future. And in particular, there is one aspect of the physics which I think we will really start learning more and more about, and this is this interface between few body quantum mechanics, where we learn right from the beginning, you know, that, you know, everything should be coherent, unitary, and indeed if you experiment with single atoms, that's what we see. But then we also, in the next, you know, course, we learn about things like statistical physics. And there we learn about things like equilibrium postulates, thermal ensembles, phases of matter. And actually, if you start thinking about them, you know, these two things are really not quite compatible. And so the important question is, you know, how does this kind of first type of physics go in the second type of physics? You know, when does it go? What's the dynamics? Does it always go? And actually, this is the aspect which at least this kind of medium-scale quantum machines will really allow us to study. So basically, what it involves is understanding on equilibrium many-body dynamics, questions about thermalizations, questions about localization, long-range interactions. And at the end, what we are hoping to really do is start discovering new stable quantum states of matter away from equilibrium, and hopefully these new states of matter will also inform us about new possible applications and ideas like information processing, algorithms, maybe metrology, and things like this. Okay, so with this motivation, here is a plan for what I'd like to talk about today. So I will tell you about a new approach to building scalable quantum systems, which actually will make use of what we call atom-by-atom assembly of strongly interacting arrays. And I will tell you also how we make them interact strongly by exciting them into the Rydberg, atomic Rydberg states. And then I will describe our recent work about studying many body dynamics on this so-called Rydberg quantum simulator. You know, I will talk about how we can study, for example, properties of phase transitions, and also will tell you about small first discoveries which we are making with this system. And if I have time at the end, I will maybe try to connect it to the first session about, in particular, our work towards quantum optimization. Okay, so as a key building blocks in our system, we will make use of isolated neutral atoms. Those systems are known for some special features. For example, they're known for their excellent coherence. So for example, think about optical clocks. They're built of neutral atoms, the best clocks, and they are some of the most coherent objects around around us. So it's also easy to create large number of identical neutral atoms, and these also atoms can be strongly coupled to light. But also there are many challenges, and in particular, the generic challenges that the atoms in a gas phase, at least, they interact very weakly with each other. And also, these neutral atoms are very hard to control individually, at least if you think about a large number of those. So we are basically addressing these challenges, and our approach makes use of what we call atom-by-atom assembly. So basically, the idea is the following. So we start with the gas of pre-cooled atoms, and we just shine tightly focused optical beams into this kind of vacuum chamber, and many of them, you know. So, and what happens in this case is that this optical traps acts as a kind of tweezers, so they're called optical tweezers. And basically, you know, if you focus the light tightly enough, each of these tweezers can contain at most one atom. But of course, what happens in reality is that, you know, at each kind of attempt to load them, they are loaded randomly, so the system has a lot of entropy. So to remove the entropy, we make use of something which is kind of akin to Maxwell's daemon. So basically what we do, we take a picture of these atoms and figure out which traps are empty and which are full, and then we just remove the empty trap and rearrange the remaining atoms in a desired configuration. And that's our starting point. So then, of course, up to now, everything is classical. We now would like to encode the qubits and make these qubits interact. And actually, in order to do it, we need to engineer the interaction Hamiltonian. And we can do it by either exciting atoms into highly excited states, such as Rydberg states, and they start talking to each other. Or we can also, in a separate experiment, actually make them interact by means of this kind of sophisticated optical waveguides called photonic crystals. So in the following, I'll focus on this first approach, but let me just first, you know, kind of just one slide about how this experiment works. Actually, the key element in this experiment is a so-called acousto-optic deflector. And what it does, it takes just one laser beam, you know, and then kind of decomposes it, you know, creates a bunch of these separate beams, each of which acts as a trap. And basically, you know, what happens is that, you know, all of these beams are controlled by basically applying the radio frequency tone. For each radio frequency tone, we get one deflected beam, and then we just focus these beams into the vacuum chamber, and then, you know, load the atoms, take a picture, and then activate a very fast feedback procedure to just rearrange the trap. So that's actually kind of a concept is very simple. So this is the people who actually has done this work, and I'd like to emphasize in particular that this is actually a wonderful collaboration between my group, the group of Markus Greiner at Harvard and Vladan Vuletic at MIT, and now also the group of Manuel Enders, who is now at Caltech, but he was the one who actually started building this experiment. So let me just show you, just a kind of as an entertainment, couple of movies, how these, you know, traps are loaded in real time. So basically, what I will show here is basically two pictures, the picture before the rearrangement and the picture after the rearrangement. They're a little bit slowed down compared to the actual experiment to just see. So this is the load, in this case, 101 tweezer, and then basically the first one is completely random, and basically then in this experiment we just try to shift them all to the left, and what you see is that the second picture, you know, is much more regular array compared to the first one. So you can actually quantify it using various ways. For example, how big an array you can prepare, and you know, in practice, we can prepare something like around 60 atoms, you know, or the time, and basically, you know, also, you know, basically for fraction, in a fraction of the second, we can load very easily 50 or 60 atoms. And of course, also we can the final configuration does not have to be regular. So, for example, this here we attempt to make clusters of 2. Here we attempt to make clusters of 10, and these are just really single shot, single atom images. And what you see is that this procedure here works pretty well, but it's not perfect. For example, this is one atom missing. Here is one atom missing. But most of them, you know, are successful. Everything works. And of course, what we can do, we can also dynamically change this configuration. For example, you know, we can vary the geometry with this repetition, and then for the small contribution to a looking lab, we can, you know, design, write your name, for example, you know, with single atoms. Okay, so what we would like to do next is make the atoms interact, and in order to do that, we actually excite the atoms from the ground state into the Rydberg state. So these two states at the end will be our qubit states. The reason why we choose the Rydberg states is because they combine long lifetimes and very strong interactions. So in particular, the kind of very basic van der Waal interaction scales as an 11th power of principal quantum numbers. And actually, in particular, for n equals 100, around 100, where the typical quantum number we like to work with, this interaction is 14 orders of magnitude stronger than interaction between the ground state atoms. So it's a big number. And so what it means in practice, for example, if you try to drive these atoms coherently, for example, with this, you know, electromagnetic field with the Rabi frequency here, so what happens if the atoms are very far away, they will be driven completely independently, but when you bring them, start to bring them close, what will happen is eventually this interaction will take over, and starting from distances of about 10 or so microns, just with one tone of electromagnetic field, you will not be able to excite two atoms. So that's this effect of the so-called Rydberg blockade. So in this case, if you start the atoms in the ground state and drive them, you can excite one of the atoms, but never two. And so that's the idea of this dipole blockade. So and basically, interaction between Rydberg atoms block multiple excitations. And for example, if you start with a cloud of atoms, which is smaller than the so-called blockade radius, what will happen is that you will just be able to excite only one of them. And you know, actually, you can do it coherently, so you'll observe something like Rabi oscillations, but you will be able to only excite one. And the characteristic of this Rabi oscillation is this of this collective Rabi oscillation is enhancement of the rate by factor of n of the Rabi frequency by factor of square root of n. So that's the idea of this dipole blockade, and this idea has been around a long time ago, and it's been exploited in many experiments around the world. So let's now see how we can combine it with our atom array approach. So specifically, in this experiment here, what we'll do, we'll create an atom array in a desired configuration and just excite it. We will excite it homogeneously. In practice, we do it by using the two photon transition, two colors of lasers. But basically, then what we can do is we can just start preparing clusters of atoms. So here are the atoms, individual atoms are prepared in the first trace, isolated, they're spaced by large distance, and we see very nice Rabi oscillations here between the ground state and the Rydberg state. So here are the clusters of pairs of atoms. So in this case, we can only excite one atom. Right, you know, but the Rabi frequency is a little bit faster, you know. If this is a triplet atom, once again, only one of them can be excited and Rabi frequency still increases. And so this is, you know, basically this Rabi oscillation occur between all atoms in the ground state and one atom excited. And this has this characteristic scaling square root of n, you know, up to certain size, you know, which is basically given by this blockade radius. So that just illustrates how this mechanism works. In the following, in the remaining of my talk, I will actually be talking about the situations where we go way beyond this blockade radius, because then that's where interesting dynamics start. And you know, then you know, these dynamics will generally be quite complex, and that will be the subject of my discussion here involving Rydberg quantum simulator. So let's kind of recap now, just sort of on a theoretical basis, what is the model which we would like to study. So we'll start with an array, and you know, in each sort of site there will be one atom. And basically, I would like to excite this atom from the ground state into a Rydberg state. And you know, if n is a number of Rydberg atoms on each site, then this Hamiltonian, which will describe this array, will be this kind of Ising type Hamiltonian, which has this spin flip term. This has a detuning term, which acts as an effective field in the z direction, and also the interaction. So let's first kind of examine ground state properties of the system as a function of detuning and say the interaction range. And let's first focus on the detuning term. So if the detuning initially is negative, clearly you want all atoms to be in the ground state, and that's actually a very nice state for us to start with. So basically, you know, here all atoms are in the ground state. But then if you change the tuning and make it positive, then you'd like to excite as many atoms as possible, right? So it's like changing the Z field in the Ising model. So that will be the result. But now let's turn on the interaction, and in particular, think about what will happen, you know, if we have this blockade effect. So if the blockade takes place, then you would like to excite as many atoms as possible, you know, but you know, you will not be able to excite the atoms kind of on a nearby lattice site. So as a result, we will have this kind of Z2 order, is basically anti-ferromagnetic order, or in the language of Eddy, this will be a ring of disagrees, or a line of disagrees, right? So, but then of course we don't need to stop there. What we can do, we can increase the interaction range, and then basically, you know, there will be another phase, which is where you break Z3 symmetry, you know, or the phase which will bring Z4 symmetry, etc. So this phase diagram has actually been studied by Subir and his co-workers, which actually provides a very nice benchmark for us to really understand what's going on. So basically, what we'll do now first is we'll prepare all atoms in the ground state, and then we'll just try to kind of go, you know, adiabatically across this phase transition. And to begin with, we will start with a situation where we have very strong interaction between nearest neighbors, and then basically very weak interaction between second nearest neighbor. So this is kind of referenced with respect to this Rabi frequency. So for example, what we can do, we can start with all atoms in the ground state and then approach the phase transition and try to go, approach this, you know, transition, yeah, you know, so, and then go slowly across that, and then basically, you know, just see what the resulting pattern is. And for the case of the free atoms, you know, it's very clear what will happen. So in the case, so these are trajectories for all free atoms, as you basically change the detuning across the resonance, and what you do, you just excite the edge atoms and the middle atoms, because of blockade, will be in the ground state, right? So it's very simple. But of course, free atoms is not really a many-body system. So what we can do now is we can, you know, increase the number of atoms. So here is the same phenomenon occurring for 9 atoms. So these are trajectories of all 9 atoms, and then the resulting state, you know, has this Z2 order, you know, up, down, up, down. Or with 13 atoms, you know, the same thing happens. So here is actually kind of a single shot images of atoms before the transition, after transition. So actually what we observe after the transitions, we image only ground state atoms, and basically these Rydberg atoms appear as holes, right? And this is perfectly ordered 13 atom chain. But okay, I told you that we have some kind of programmable aspect to our system, and one thing which we can do is we can change the interaction range very easily. We can either do it by choosing a different Rydberg state to go to, or we can just, you know, change the separation between the atoms. And so if we, for example, change atomic separation, you know, bring the atoms closer, this effectively increases the interaction range, then for the same 13 atom system, we can actually very easily enter now a Z3 ordered phase, you know, or a Z4 ordered phase. Now, this really shows kind of that programmable aspect of our approach. So this programmable interaction basically result in a desired different symmetry breaking. And you know, I must say, whereas this first transition is actually reasonably well understood, these other transitions are very, very interesting and very intriguing. There is a lot of unknown. But let's now focus on the Z2 transition and, you know, try to see how well our system works if we scale the size. So specifically, we can maybe start with a small system size with 7 atoms, where we can still do complete simulations. And we can compare our experimental result with the result of numerical simulation. And what you see is that basically our experiment, you know, for example, here we look at the many body overlap. So this is kind of the state, for example, with a perfect order. So what we see is that basically our experiment is in a very good agreement. So the only correction which has been made here is for the final state redout fidelity. So we have a good redout fidelity, but not perfect. It's about 95%. And for, you know, when the system size increases, it actually matters. But what we can do at this point, we can just try to increase our system size. And in particular, we can go to large systems up to 51 atoms, you know, in which case the Hilbert space is actually quite sizable. And what we find is that this overlap with the perfectly ordered ground state actually decreases, but even for this large system size, it's actually still respectable. It's about 1%. So you just need to, you know, run, you know, this machine, you know, about 100 times to kind of see this this state. Moreover, if we now start examining, you know, each individual states which we can observe, and basically looking at the number of occurrences of which state, we find that the most probable state which we observed, you know, by far, is this very special state, which is perfectly ordered state. So this is once again, you know, just we can look at real images to see what happens. So this is, you know, the single shot image before we start the evolution. And then, you know, after we start the evolution in different runs, we'll see different things, you know. So sometimes we will see this perfectly ordered state, you know, this is this 1% in all cases. But in most of the cases, we will not see it. We will see a state with, you know, where we have this relatively long chains of perfect order, and they're now interrupted by the defects, and these defects are basically domain walls. And so what we can do, for example, we can try to measure things like domain wall density or fluctuations, variance in domain wall density, and actually that allows us to, for example, pinpoint exactly, you know, where the phase transition occurs in the system. So in particular, this is a mean domain wall density, and this is a variance. And, you know, basically what we see is that this mean domain wall density varies smoothly, and at the same time, the variance is enhanced at some point. And this is basically a classic kind of second order Ising type phase transition. In fact, by looking at the variance, we can precisely pinpoint where the phase transition occurs. It actually turns out to be in a pretty good agreement with the calculations by Subir and co-workers. But actually there is a lot more which we can do with this system. So for example, we can not just plot the average and the variance, we can plot the entire distribution of these domain walls. So this is a measured distribution. So as I already mentioned, we know that we have imperfect detection, a final state detection, we can correct for it. Actually, this is a corrected distribution. What we see is that on the, you know, on the average, we see something like 2 to 4 domain walls in our final state. This actually corresponds to 1 to 2 errors just because of the counting. So in the entire system, in the entire transition, we see 1 to 2 errors, and actually we kind of know where our errors coming from. Is one mechanism is kind of non-adiabatic excitation, which is, you know, there is related to something like Keeble-Zurich mechanism. But also, you know, we have during the entire coherent evolution, we have about 1% of spontaneous emission per atom. So it's a small number, but you multiply it by 50 atoms and you already, you know, see that we can have this kind of errors also occurring. So one thing that, you know, so is that, you know, this resulting state is actually not thermal. So if we just take an average number and try to, you know, kind of, you know, fit it, you know, we find that it does not describe thermal distribution. This is something that I will return to in a second. But basically what you see immediately is that this kind of, you know, approach allows us to really have quite unique insights in phase transitions, under the physics of a phase transitions. Okay, so I already mentioned that, you know, the key kind of new sort of frontier or the opportunity here is to study non-equilibrium states. And you know, we have done the first experiments to really explore that. And in order to do it, what we have done is the following. So we basically started with our array and then you know, did the adiabatic transition across basically across this phase transition point, as already discussed. So at this point, you know, we prepare for this system of five atoms, we prepare this kind of ordered Z2 ordered state. But then, you know, after that, instead of kind of measuring it, what we have done is we have basically rapidly, you know, changed the detuning. It corresponds to something like a quench, a rapid change of the magnetic field. And we changed and we moved this detuning, put this detuning just across the phase transition point. So at this point, you would expect that, you know, basically we have dumped a lot of energy on the system, so it should actually just thermalize. But yet what we observed was something kind of very special. So what you see now is now individual atom trajectories. What you see is that the system does not, you know, it kind of loses its original order, but then it does not just come to some kind of equilibrium, but there is some kind of, you know, dynamics, something is going on. And actually, I can just, you know, make some snapshots. In fact, what happens is at some point, you know, if you had this, you know, up, down order, you know, then later it's down, up, down, up. So it's kind of a complementary order. Then you wait a little bit more, and then basically the original order, you know, comes out. So what is going on? So is it a finite size effect? So we can, of course, now, you know, do the same experiment by changing the system size. So this is 5, 6, 9, 10 atoms. You see even for 10 atoms, you see there is something going on. So this is, for example, snapshots for 9 atoms, you know, again, initially you have Z2 ordered state, and then, you know, sometime later, complementary order appears, and then original order appears again. So what's happening? So basically, you know, so here is now the same effect quantified in terms of domain wall density, and these are the two traces. One is experimental result for 9 atom, another one for 51 atom. And what you see indeed, initially we have, you know, low domain wall density, then domain wall density basically, you know, increases, but then, you know, this original order tends to reappear. So moreover, this kind of this frequency of these oscillations is actually something which is actually related to our Drybeak frequency, but not equal. So basically, and moreover, finally, this decay is actually somehow, in terms of timing, you know, corresponds to the second nearest neighbor coupling. So so what's going on? So basically, you know, what's the physical origin of this effect? So we are dealing with non-integrable many-body systems, and so basically that one should generically thermalize. This is a system under this blockade. You can ask maybe this blockade kind of reduces the Hilbert space dimension. It actually turns out that it does, but you know, still this Hilbert space dimension available, Hilbert space dimension scales exponentially with n. It actually scales as a golden ratio to power n. It is actually not an accident. We can discuss it later. So we have started to kind of try to understand the physics of these emerging oscillations by just doing simulations for small systems. And what we see indeed, you know, in simulations, these oscillations persist. And the frequency kind of converges as the system size increases to something which is kind of fixed, which is not the normal Rabi oscillation frequency. It's close to the square root of 2 value, but not exactly that. So what's going on? So we don't really know, but here are some glimpses. So basically, if you think about this blockaded system, you can maybe first, you know, consider independent dimers evolving, and actually these independent dimers under the blockade condition will precisely have the square root of 2 change in Rabi frequency, so they are like effective spin 1 systems, and the spin 1 systems will precisely pick up the square root of 2. But then, of course, this picture isn't complete because these dimers interact very strongly. So basically, you know, even better approximation, you can construct a matrix product state, which actually yields a frequency within about 10%, but it doesn't really answer the fundamental question. So why does not it thermalize? So some glimpse into that can be obtained by looking at simulations for a smaller system size, and these are simulations for 21 atoms. So basically what we see here is that if we only include blockade constraint, we see that, you know, we see these oscillations, and we see that the entanglement entropy grows actually very, very slowly. In fact, these oscillations persist, as far as we can judge, to kind of infinitely long times. So if we include long-range interactions, that results in a decay of these oscillations, and indeed this decay is actually consistent with what we observe. So basically, we think that these oscillations are associated due to the slow growth of entanglement, which is likely due to this constrained dynamics, and decay is clearly due to long-range interactions, but we don't really at the end know what's the kind of fundamental physical reason. So it's actually, our system is not close to integrability. This is also cannot really be thought about as a kind of pre-thermalization, so it's likely due to the constrained dynamics, but there are some actually interesting connections. So in particular, our system can be mapped directly into something which is called quantum dimer model, and actually it's kind of pretty directly related to some work on the so-called golden chains here at the station Q. And in fact, the Fibonacci anyon is one point in our phase diagram which we can access. But of course, what we are doing now is dynamics. We are, you know, way away from this kind of ground state property. So also maybe some interesting connections to many body localization without disorder, or perhaps something else. But what I must say, what I really find striking here is that you would think that, you know, Ising model is something which is really should be very well understood. Yet the first experiment, you know, we do with the system by taking it away from the from equilibrium, you know, shows some surprise. So I think there is much more to come. So I think, you know, we are kind of entering a new exciting area of what I would say programmable quantum machines, or quantum simulations, simulators. So we are in the lab, we are working on extending our system to 2D, increasing the number of qubits, including improving coherence. As I said, we already started to be limited by coherence, and we're also working on individual atom control. So we certainly would like to do experiments probe entanglement. We are thinking about scrambling, measuring critical exponents, in particular near the Z3 and Z4 order. They are really not very well understood. So as I mentioned, there are connections to topological excitation, the Fibonacci anions, and I should note that, you know, our system is extremely well suited to test some of this approximate optimization algorithms, which Eddie discussed. So if I have maybe one more minute, I could actually, you know, give some specific ideas, you know, or directions which we are thinking about. So, okay, one kind of avenue involves exploring the problems which are called maximum independent set. And the idea here is very simple. So suppose you have a graph with some vertices, and basically what you would like to do is you would like to find kind of configurations which are called independent sets, basically, you know, where, you know, the vertices such that they don't have neighbors on the, you know, on a given graph. And basically the problem of maximum independent set is to basically find the set such that you have maximal number of such vertices. Right, that's what's called maximum independent set problem. So in this, on this graph, this is a maximum independent set. So now it is actually a complex problem. So you can formulate it as a decision problem. Is there an independent set of the size k? And this problem is NP-complete. One can also formulate it as an optimization problem, you know, and this even approximate optimization is known to be NP-hard. So let me just kind of to really connect to what I have talked about, just, you know, pick some specific graph. It's actually a simple graph. It's called a unit disk graph. And basically, in this unit disk graphs, vertices within certain distance, d, are connected. So this is, you know, the graph. And basically, you can just ask the question, what's the maximum independent set on this kind of unit disk graph? So clearly, complexity is somewhat reduced compared to what we have talked about. But, you know, it's still actually a very complex problem. Moreover, this kind of, you know, graph is something that you must have seen at least once in your life, right? For example, when you're bored in an airline, you know, kind of an airport. So what it really tells you that this actually is a problem which has many real-world applications, in particular design of networks of different sorts. So even on a unit disk graph, the problem is still NP-complete. And actually, if you followed the rest of my talk, you will realize that this is exactly corresponds to the problem which we are trying to solve with our Rydberg Block 8 Hamiltonian. So specifically, the Hamiltonian of this kind with positive U and which provides a constraint, and positive delta, precisely tries to optimize the number of excited Rydberg atoms subject to this constraint. It's exactly this problem. So we start to think how to actually can solve this kind of problem and encode it in our machine. So we're thinking about both adiabatic evolutions. I guess there are some question marks about it, but in particular, the first things we started, first instances of looking at approximate optimization actually look very, very promising. And just to give you a little bit one more kind of slide of the kind of entertainment, the way how actually we're implementing it is, so far we just had one of these acousto-optic deflectors. So these are basically devices you use for scanners, barcode scanners, right? We just have one of them, then we create, a bunch of these, tweezers. But, we can have two of them and create a pattern like this, and this is now a pattern of kind of 8x8 traps. In this case, they're kind of loaded randomly. We also started doing some rearrangement. So here about 40, I guess, atoms, which we rearrange in this kind of into ladders, So I think this is really an exciting frontier, and I think it really kind of bridges many body physics to these problems of quantum optimization. So I think I used up my time here. Thank you very much for your attention.
I have a small question.
Yeah.
You said that about 50 atoms could be loaded in 0.3 seconds. You also said that neutral atoms are useful because they have long coherence properties.
Yeah. Yeah.
You might have said this and I missed it, but what is the comparison of the 0.3 second load time to the coherence time of your atoms?
Yeah, so actually, okay, so there's what we do, there's several elements. So first we load the atoms, it takes a certain number of time, but then we run the coherent, kind of operation, a coherent evolution lasts actually about a microsecond only, right? So it's much, much shorter than loading. And during this microsecond, as I kind of indicated, so in terms of real kind of irreversible coupling, at the moment we have about 1% of error per atom, and this is due to spontaneous emission. It's kind of at the technical reason, so by increasing laser power and things like this, we certainly can push it by an order of magnitude, but that gives you kind of a sense that maybe we can experiment with kind of 1,000 or so atoms. That's without with making few mistakes.
Yes, in the maximum independent set problem, the graph was defined in terms of some geometric distance.
That's right.
But in the experimental setting, that distance would be kind of a soft definition, right?
That's right.
Do you know if the problem becomes easy in that case, classically?
Well, okay. So first off, we have this, one over six constraint. So it's actually pretty hard, and basically that's what we have seen now by experimenting with actually creating, for example, stable Z2, Z3, and Z4 order. So I don't think that this will kind of change the complexity. But, this certainly brings up a question. So we'll, at the end, we'll implement something which is not exactly the cost function, but some approximation, right? And that's where, for example, the kind of questions that Eddie is asking become very, very relevant. So in this case, we believe we can actually make it a very good approximation, but, still this is a question. And actually, I should also note that just in terms of this kind of, just purely geometrical arrangements, of course, one control knob. What we can do is in a single experiment, we can vary the range of this by just changing, for example, the Rabi frequency, right? And that, for example, should allow us to access much more complex graphs.
So I was just hoping to get a sense of, I didn't quite get a sense of what all the knobs are that are available. So if we were to phrase it in terms of, which 2-qubit gates can you apply to which qubits?
Yeah.
How close to universal is it, or which ones are the good ones?
Yeah. The control knobs. So kind of ideally, we can do everything, right? So, but it comes. with some steps of added complexity. So what we can do is we can apply sigma z operations by just changing laser detuning. And already at the moment, we can actually do it individually on all atoms. It's not what we have done in this experiment, but it's actually easy for us to do. So then we can apply the single qubit rotation.
Hadamard.
And you know, there we can apply sigma x, sigma y, what have you. So far we can only do it globally, you know, but we have started also working on the local addressing. But you know, that will be actually, it will increase the complexity, but it's possible. Finally, you know, what is Rydberg interactions provide basically kind of a sigma z interaction, right? And you know, in principle, this is, you know, controlled nodes, you know, everything. So, you know, when we work under this blockade condition, this is actually somewhat a special class of these operations. It actually turns out it's very convenient to work for us under these blockade conditions, because then these kind of two-bit operations become very robust. Right? For example, they stop depending on exact positions of atoms and things like this. So this, you know, somewhat restricts the set of operations, but it's not fundamental, right? So we can sort of, so in principle, you know, so we have things which we can do right now very, very well. But, you know, if you want some more, you know, it's okay. It's just some, then it, you know, the core, it's just, a, you know, laser power and kind of money and graduate student time.
Right, so I have a quick question. So, yeah. You know, you showed that kind of finding the ground state of these atom arrays should be an NP-complete problem.
Yeah.
So could you also view this as, you know, some sort of evidence that it should be very difficult for you to be able to prepare the ground state, like this graph of your probability of accepting, you know, finding ground state should keep going down?
That's right. So it's, you know, that's what we expect. That this would, so it eventually, okay, so this for the order arrays, you know, I mean, at least this kind of Z2 transition, I mean, it's relatively well understood. The gap there closes linearly with a number of atoms, right? So it's actually a simple instance if you want, right? Certainly, you know, if you want to think about things like optimization, we would actually end up looking at some much more complicated kind of glassy type graphs, right? And so we certainly expect that finding though the ground state of walls will be actually exponentially hard. But at the same time, if your question is, for example, about approximate optimization, you know, I think, you know, that I view as a much more promising, you know, and I think we should be able to do it. We actually started numerically playing, you know, with kind of small system sizes, and actually it looks very promising, but we'll find out, you know. So basically, you know, I think to really do interesting experiments here would require a little bit more than 50 qubits, you know, maybe a couple hundred, but you know, it's certainly within the reach. So.
All right. And with that, we'll break for lunch. Let's thank our speaker again.